Veselé. Pasch Bola. Mystery Sparsha. Now, Bolak is a very strange character. Bolak is a very strange character. He's a rasa. He's not a good guy. We don't like him. He has amazing power. We have to understand what's the root of his power. What is he trying to do? What's his mistake? Now you and I have to be careful with such mistakes. What is the meaning of what Chazal tell us of the difference between a Jew, between Avraham Avinu, or the students of Avraham Avinu, and the students of Bilam, is the difference between an Ayin Tova and an Ayin Ra'a. The Bilam is a person with an evil eye. We're not talking about anything mystical here. What does this mean? An Ayin Ra'a. Person with an evil eye, and that the descendants of Avraham Avinu, the Jewish people, are called people who have an Ayin Tova. Ayin Tova, a good eye. What does this mean? So first of all, a little bit of record, a little bit of background of what the parasha we were holding now, Sefer Bamidbar. The book of Bamidbar is describing to us all the trials and tribulations of the Jewish people as they're preparing to enter Eretz Yisrael, they're going through the desert and all things that they have to go through to come to Eretz Yisrael. The first half of the Sefer, the first half of the book of Bamidbar deals primarily with domestic problems. Domestic problems, imperial problems. Problems with the spies, with the complaints that the Jewish people had about their food, the problem with Korach and the rebellion against Moshe and Aaron, the problem with Moshe and Aaron speaking Lashon Hara about Moshe Rabbeinu. So the first half of Bamidbar deals mostly with the Jewish people traveling, making their way slowly through the desert, and problems that they had to confront, domestic problems within the Mishpach, problems amongst themselves. That's what the first half of the book of Bamidbar is about. The second half of Bamidbar is dealing really with foreign problems, with our relationship with nations outside of ourselves, with Edom and Sichon and Og and Moab and Midian. The second half of Bamidbar really is describing our confrontation with these nations. As we're getting closer to Eretz Yisrael, we are metaphorical, is going to lead us into a normal social, political, economic life. Before we come to Eretz Yisrael, we have to contend with these nations. As we get closer to Eretz Yisrael, the nations become more and more frightened. The nations are more and more afraid of the Jewish people. It says in the Shir by the Shalat, it says, Shomu Amir, Omnim Yegozim Chilokaz Yoshvei Chiloshes, that there was a terror, a complete and absolute terror that took hold, that took grip of the nations that heard that B'nai Yisrael were coming. And Rachav, in Eretz Yisrael, says, V'chinot lo ha'imot cham alayinu. Rachav described the feeling of the people who were living in Canaan, the Goyim who were living in Eretz Yisrael, that the terror and a fear, a tremendous fear of the Jewish people. The climax of this sense of fear was when the two kings, Sichon and Og, two powerful kings, Malchei HaMori, the two kings, Sihon and Og, who fought the Jewish people right by the threshold, by the entrance of Eretz Yisrael. When those two kings succumbed, when those two kings were destroyed, and their nations were destroyed by the Jewish people, at that point, as Rashi begins in this week's parasha, Manoitza l'ktanim mehem la'ato. All the other nations said, look, if the Jews could defeat Sichon and Og, then what could small people like us do? There's nothing to talk about. We're finished. And at this point, I want to give you a little background. It's at this point in time that Balak, and he sought the services of Bilam HaRasha. And why does Balak, what does Balak want to accomplish? Because at this point, by this time Balak realizes, the nation has realized, that physically the Jewish people cannot be defeated. So why does Balak hire Bilam? Because since he realizes that there's nothing physical in the world that can stand before the Jewish people, once Sichon and Og, these two powerful kings, are defeated. So there's nothing natural that can, at this point, take care of the Jews. You can't defeat them in a natural way. So what happens when all natural means and methods fail? Then you seek the supernatural. Then you look for some other way of succeeding. So because Bilam was recognized in the world as being the master sorcerer, the great power in the world of the supernatural. So because of that, Balak sought the services of Bilam, because physically the Jews couldn't be defeated. So he understood, Balak understood that he was standing before some sort of a spiritual power that the Jewish people have, and in order to contend with this spiritual power, one must seek the help of a person who is spiritually powerful. Now here we begin to understand. You must understand that when in history we've seen certain people who we consider to be Rishayim, we consider to be evil, and it's true that these people were evil. But when we speak about, for instance, about Yashka, just like Jesus, so one mustn't think that we're dealing here with a person that wasn't spiritually powerful. We're talking about somebody that had immense spiritual power. Tremendous spiritual power. A person like Bilam was also not a small person. Bilam was not a small person. Shabtai Tzvi, a false Mashiach, you heard of Shabtai Tzvi. He wasn't a small person. These are Anshei Ruach, these are people of tremendous spiritual power. However, they derive their spiritual strength from the side of Tov, from the side of emptiness, from the side of Tumah, of impurity. Bilam, Chazal say that Bilam. Chazal tell us about Bilam, to understand who he was. Chazal say on the pasuk below, "Come Navi Od Yisrael Kemoshe." It says in the pasuk that no prophet would arise. No prophet could arise like Moshe Rabbeinu. But it says, "Come Navi Od Yisrael Kemoshe." No Navi, no prophet among the Jews could be like Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Chazal say, "Yisrael may come, Aval Beumas Olam come." Umanu Bilam. That by the Jews there can never be a prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu, but the Goyim there could be a prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu. And it's a painful thing to even say, but I would never say, we would say this thing, get in trouble. Because I'll say that by the Jews we never had a prophet equal to Moshe Rabbeinu. But by the Goyim that they had a prophet, and because I'll say this, that's equal to Moshe Rabbeinu. And who is that? Well, Bilam. So Bilam is not the way that we imagine, you know, when we read all those Midrashim and we're children, we see the cartoons of some, you know, goofy looking guy and a donkey. Bilam is a philosopher of world importance, a world class philosopher thinker, sorcerer, a spiritualist, a person with intense spiritual courage, intense spiritual power. That's who we're dealing with. The Torah itself says on Bilam, Hayodea Da'at Elyon. Hayodea Da'at Elyon. What does that mean? He knows the thoughts of the higher world. He knows what God is thinking, whatever that means. He knows what's going on in the higher world. Hayodea Da'at Elyon. Hayodea Da'at Elyon. He's in touch with the thoughts of the higher world. Umachna Shakai Yatze. And he sees visions of Hashem. So, first of all, Aleph, we must recognize, before we can understand what Bilam is coming with, we're not dealing here with an idiot, we're not dealing here with some sort of a two-bit magician, some guy from the circus, we're dealing here with a profound thinker, a philosopher, with great spiritual power that he draws from the side of you, but tremendous spiritual power. Therefore, the story of the parasha of Bilam being hired to curse Balak, to curse the Jewish people, was to us was so silly. It was so silly. Hashem's going to let us. What's the whole thing? What's going on over here? That Bilam is being hired. We're not dealing in the parish of Shpruchim. We're not dealing with silliness, with small things. How could such a thing be? How could it be that a person's being hired? How could it be that a person's being hired to curse the Jewish people when Hashem wants to bless them? How could that work? So in Hebrew, the word for witchcraft or sorcery, the word is Torah, that means witchcraft or sorcery, is kishuv, mechashvin, a machshesha. A witch, a sorcerer, is called kishuv. And the Gemara says, on the mechashvin, on these people, why are they called mechashvin? The Gemara says, because the mechashvin, because these people, mechashvin pamalya shalmala, they have the ability to undermine, to fight against the heavenly army, against the angels, against Hashem. They have such power. How could that be? How could that be? Because there's a power of, there's a spiritual power in the world that can contend with the spiritual power of us. That doesn't mean, God forbid, that anything in the world is more powerful than Hashem. So what does it mean? So the explanation, as we've been taught in the Torah Makadoshim, is that the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the same way that Hashem has given the human being free choice, and that he has the choice to do things in this world either that are good or to do things that are evil, that's his choice in the world. That he can make physical choices to do a mitzvah, he can make a physical choice to do an aveirah, to do a sin, to do a mitzvah, that's up to him. A person has the ability to destroy something. If a person wants to go and punch a hole in the wall, if he's able to, he can do it. If not, he can hire somebody to do it. The same way that a person was given the physical power, now especially in our times we see that human beings have the power to manage to destroy the world. To destroy the world. People have the power to destroy the world. The same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Hashem gave the human being physical power that can either be creative, constructive, or physical power that can chalila be destructive, so too Hashem has placed in the world, listen carefully, Hashem has placed at the disposal of the world, there are very few people now, if anybody knows how to use these things, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu has put into the world spiritual powers that a human being can use in a constructive way, like tzaddikim that have enormous power to see and to help, and even to perform miracles, with the help of Hashem to perform miracles. And so too, there are destructive spiritual powers in the world. According to Chazal, Avraham, when he gave the gift to the children of the concubines, right? Says that the gift, he gave gifts to the children of the concubines, to his other wives, their children. So, according to the Zohar Kodesh, he gave them certain shemot, he gave them certain names, and how to use these names, holy names of Hashem, and how to use these names in order to do certain things. I don't know what that means exactly. But it does mean that there are certain powers, spiritual powers, that exist in the world, just people are on such a small level now, they don't know how to use them. But there were once upon a time great people of evil who were able to draw from these powers of tumah and impurity, and they were able to use these powers in a way that is opposed to Hashem's will. The same way that you and I can take our tefillin, God forbid, and put the tefillin in the garbage can, no one's going to stop you from doing it. You have the ability in your life to make a choice to do a mitzvah, not to do a mitzvah. You have the ability to rebel against the king to the point that the Rav Moshe Kodavera says in his famous say for the Tzaima Devarah, Rav Moshe Kodavera says that the greatest humiliation of the king is that he gives you, Hashem gives us our strength. We spoke by this Rosh Hashanah time, in Kippur time. Hashem gives us the strength. Hashem gives us our lives. He gives us the soul that we can live. And when a person sins, he's taking the very strength that Hashem gave him to use against Hashem. And Hashem gave you that power. Is there any greater humiliation? And I always give the example, you know, that you ask your father, can I borrow the car? Dad, you have the keys. He says, sure. Then you run him over in the driveway. Is there anything more humiliating, disgusting, and disgraceful for a child to take the very car that his father gave him to use as a favor, because he loves him, and to use it against your father? And how many times we do these things? How many times we do these things? We give the things that were given to us from love, and we use them against the people that gave them to us. So Hashem gives us the power to serve Him. He gives us a soul. He gives us powers that are physical and spiritual. And the same way that you have a choice to physically rebel against the very one who loves you and gave you those powers, And you could use your mouth to speak Lashon Hara, you could use a mouth to speak obscenities, the same mouth that God gave you to say words of Torah and Tefillah, to speak to Him, and to use to encourage Jews and to help people. The same mouth you could use to humiliate and to destroy. And so too, spiritually, God gave talents in the world that you can use in a creative way, and tzaddikim had an amazing power. In our generation, we were privileged to see tzaddikim like the Babasali and the Safarov that had such amazing powers. And the Zaykas of Yishlim Mirel, the Mr. Rebbe and Monsi, has amazing cause of holiness to perform revealed miracles, mamish revealed miracles. But the Babasali, there were miracles that were rolling under the table. The Babasali died only 14 years ago, 13 years ago. By him, there were miracles rolling under the table. I was privileged to see myself miracles made. They were rolling under the table. There are spiritual powers that man has access to, just like he has access to physical powers. If he chooses to use them in a good way, they're creative and constructive. If he chooses to use them in a bad way, he can destroy them. So Bilam has tremendous power. Bilam has tremendous power. It's a power from the side of Ra that he decides to use for the side of evil, for the side of Tumah. And he is going to pit himself against God for the purpose, even though he says, I can't, I'm helpless against Hashem, but you see that he tries to pit himself against God in order to curse the Jewish people. The very nature of Bilam, you're dealing here with a person who's, I'm going to explain more as we go along, whose purpose in life is to destroy, to take away the world, to undo Hashem's world, to return things to nothingness, to emptiness. His name Bilam, Chazal say that his name Bilam, this in the word, means Bli'am. What does it mean, Bli'am? Without a nation. Now, Avraham Avinu, his whole life is godly for everybody. Even for the people of Sodom, right? When Chazal say that Avraham Avinu has a good eye, Ayin Tova, an Ayin Tova, it means that he wants that the world should live. Avraham Avinu, Moshe Rabbeinu, Yitzchak Avinu, Yaakov, Yosef, all our tzaddikim, they want life. They want the world should live. They want everything should be thriving and healthy and well. That's an Ayin Tova. They look at everything in a good way. I'll explain more. Bilam is Bli'ah. And the form of Kabbalah, Bli'if. What does it mean, if? Ayin Men. It needs to be together with something. Bli'im means he doesn't have the power to connect. He is removed from reality. He negates reality. He doesn't want the world to thrive. He doesn't want the world to continue. So as Avraham Avinu brings a blessing to the entire universe, Avraham Avinu brings a blessing to the whole world in his life, Bilam is a person that curses. And he has tremendous power to curse. Now, that's basic. Now that a little bit of the groundwork has been taken care of, now I can go into drive, into high gear. There are some Jewish philosophers, amongst them the Rambam, the exercise of love, who believe that evil doesn't exist. That evil does not exist. The Rambam held, I'm not going to explain this now, but the Rambam held that evil does not exist. Evil is simply an absence of good. Evil is an absence of good. But evil doesn't, there's no thing as evil. Evil is just that there's no good. Something where good is lacking, that's called evil. The Rambam held like this, and Sadiago held like that, and other great philosophers. This is based on the philosophy of Aristotle and his followers. But the Chachmei Emes, the masters of truth, and the Kabbalah, the Zohar Kaddish, as soon as the Bari and the Holy Baal Shem and all the Svadish and Mukhabalim and Sadiqim disagree. The Ramchal does not hold that way. He holds that.
You
have to learn the
Ramchal.
But according to Ramchal, evil has its own existence. It's not just the head of our type. Just so that the head of our type, that's what evil enters into the scene.
You mean Kabbalah? Isn't it like the removal theory
of having removed himself? I'm going to explain. That's not the Ramchal person. The Ramchal speaks, of course, about head. All the Kabbalah from speaks about symptom and sense light missing. And there, in that place, evil descends. It doesn't mean to say
Like, it's not the same as an island thing. Who's going to call it? It's not the same as an island.
I'm not the, like, half of what you
The very important thing
you
is...
You didn't
get
the other half.
Not, okay, right. If I'm just speaking about the absence of life. But I'm Carl's talking about an open code on what happens in the absence of life. What happens? That's a very good thing. It is a mysterious surprise world. It doesn't apply to the other reality of evil in the world. Above in the higher world, there's no evil, but it's clear. Just as things descend into this world and take the form, in that place where things are missing, where there's a head, where there's a lack, where there's an absence, where there's a vacuum. So then there's evil in the world. There's evil in the world that is real. It's real. And it says, in the song that there's, but Cook explained that there's two types of evil in the world. There's two types of evil. The first he calls rakosmi, which is not a Hebrew word, it's an English word. It means cosmic evil. Cosmic evil is perhaps the most frightening for people like us. Cosmic evil, or a book says that there are things that are happening in the world that just don't seem to be nice. And it has nothing to do with what people are doing, like earthquakes, that's not nice. People are living very happily someplace, and all of a sudden, the ground opens up, and everybody gets swallowed up, and it's finished. Or tidal waves. Or sickness. This type of wrath, Rav Kook describes as being a cosmic evil. It exists in the universe. One can't deny it. Yeah, the Rambam has a different explanation. What does that mean? Those who have looked at the Swarm Solution, including the Rambam Swarm, understand that the Rambam's explanation here is not enough. So there's... Correct. We're not talking about why evil is this. Let's listen to how we're going to say. We're not talking about why evil is this. We're talking about what kind and how human beings confront it. We're not going to talk about why tonight. So this is one type of evil. This is one type of wrath. Cosmic evil, suffering, children have a dying, earthquake, catastrophe, innocent people being hurt. This is one type of wrath. There's another kind of wrath. They call Ramusari, or ethical, moral evil. The first category of evil, cosmic evil, you can't blame people for earthquakes. You can't blame people. Right now you have all this, you know, everybody's blaming the use deodorant is somehow destroying the world, all these, theories that are being propagated by those who are strongly against the progress of civilization. Or sincerely concerned about the environment, which is probably just a minority. But the truth is that the first type of evil is not up to human beings. It's just it happens in the world. If you're not careful, with the ecology, so certainly you can hurt the world. But for the most part, the catastrophes that are taking place in the world are beyond the control of human beings. But the second type of evil, which is called Ramusari, or ethical immorality, that's up to human beings. People hurt each other. Visually, evil, people hurt each other, people steal, people insult, people destroy, people murder. So these are the two types of evil. The second type is a human pride. The first type of evil is a type of wrath, a type of suffering that is a part of the greed, a part of creation, that the Baruch Hu has brought into the world. But the Baruch Hu brings into the world. For whatever reason, that's not for tonight, whatever reason, but there is such a thing in the world. There's a world. There is in the world an evil that is not related to human beings. It just happens. Something falls, or something is hurt. And so on and so forth. It happens. And I said a moment ago that the concern here now is not why do these things happen. The issue now that we're going to talk about, and you'll see how this connects to Bill in a very, very, in a very important way. What we're going to talk about now is not why these things happen. It's not up to you. Moral evil is up to you. To be a nice person is up to you. Not to hurt someone else is up to you. Sometimes you feel that you can't help yourself from being hurt by people. But as far as you hurting other people, that certainly is up to you. But what about cosmic suffering? The evil or the wrath that is in the universe that seems to be beyond man's control. So the issue is not why is there evil tonight, that's not what we're talking about, but how do you deal with it? And Rav Kook says a remarkable thing in his Iris and his life of Kedusha Kodesh, his Iris HaKodesh, his life of holiness, Of Cook says, this is a remarkable historical insight,
the chlal,
to understand the world. But to understand history, of Cook says there are four approaches of how to contend with evil. Four ways, historically, that human beings have dealt with suffering. There are four different ways, four options of how people deal with suffering. And we mix and match, but there are four basic approaches. What do you do? There's a world that has all kinds of evil in it. There's sorrow. There's cosmic evil, and there's moral evil, or immorality. And there are four ways that Cook says, there are four ways that human beings historically have contended with a world that has this reality of evil in it. Four ways. The first way is the most unpleasant. Well, maybe not. It certainly sounds like it's the most horrible. He calls the first way Shi'ifa Hara HaGemura, which means he connects this with idol worship and Avodah Zarah, with classic Avodah Zarah. This way of dealing with evil is very convenient. It simply says, nothing is absolutely evil. There's nothing that's absolutely evil. If you look at the autobiography of Hitler in Mach Shemo, if you look at his autobiography, he felt that to destroy the Jewish people was the most legitimate, sanctified cause in the history of mankind. He felt that he was doing mankind a tremendous favor. And you think he was wrong? We know he was wrong. But it seems that the nations of the world agreed with him. When there were Jews that were on boats sitting outside New York City, when Franklin Roosevelt received plans of the railroad tracks that were leading to Auschwitz, and he had his flyers, and the pilots are flying daily over those tracks, and they received orders from the Department of State not to bomb Auschwitz or the tracks. So it seems that most of the world agreed with Hitler, that to get rid of the Jews would be a tremendous failure, right? It would be a tremendous failure for the world. This way of idolatry, of Cook says that Avodah Zarah legitimizes all evil. Therefore, look at this, it's an amazing thing. He says, if you study the history of idol worship, in their temples, as part of their services, there was murder, children being killed, human sacrifice, not just children, usually children. Now, why should you kill yourself? Better to kill a kid. Human sacrifice. In Tanakh we see, and historically we see, that it was a policy of idol worshippers to have in their temple prostitution. In the temple. A word for a prostitute in Tanakh is Kadesha. Kadesha, the holy one. And why? The word Kadosh means holy. So what's so holy about such a person? So the answer is, as the Mepharshim say, that in ancient civilizations, they were called Kadesha, the holy one. They were women that were set aside in these temples as part of the service. As part of the services. Kadesha. Prophet holiness. In other words, what this first approach to evil is basically saying is that everything is kosher. Instead of denying that there are things that are disgusting and wrong and evil, what this way in history has attempted to do is to take anything that you want to do to legitimize the most horrible, disgusting, low-based things in the world, and to legitimize them by saying that not, by putting them under the disguise of holiness, that not only is this not evil, not only is this not evil, killing, destruction. Destruction is in the world as well. Not only are these things not evil, they have gods, they are people that worship Satan. You know, you heard of such a thing? Satanic cults that worship evil, worship rock. In other words, they put every single thing into, they bring everything into their creatures. Not only is this not evil, but it has no you. It's holy. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. I remember when they started in the 1960s, they started opening these nudist colonies, people running around, they had these places where people going around naked. And the way that they were presenting these things on the radio, and they were talking and they were writing about the newspapers, that if you wear clothing, there's something wrong with you. Because people who are truly natural, people who are in touch with nature, people who are real, they don't wear clothes. So normal people started to think, maybe something wrong with me. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't do this. There's something immoral about wearing clothing. The legitimization of all things that are evil. There is no evil. Everything is beautiful. Everything is fine. Everything is wonderful. instead of contending with evil, evil itself receives this stamp of approval, and it hides under the disguise of holiness, and everything that is right is called holy.
This is classical
Avodah.
And there are classical idol worship, and there are bits and pieces of this that are left in modern day civilization as well. Especially in Eastern, in African and Eastern religions. There are pieces of this still remain. That's the first approach to Eden. The second approach, number two. The second approach recognizes that there's evil in the world. The first approach says, no, everything is fine. Everything is wonderful, destruction, this, that. The second approach says, no, there is evil in the world. There is evil in the world. But how do we contend with it? There's no way in the world you can contend with it. It's complete and absolute yayish. You know what I mean, yayish? Absolute despair. Giving up complete. There's nothing you can do. There's no way in the world Ra, evil, cosmic evil, immorality rules over the world. There's only, the world is headed towards destruction. And the only way that a person can be free of the horror of this world, of the evil of this world, is by dying. Therefore, in the Eastern part of the world, the religion known as Buddhism, taught that the world stinks, the world is evil, you're incapable of controlling the evil or fixing the world, there's nothing you can do about the evil in the world, there's only one thing you can do. Either you die and then you enter into some other realm, or you could experience in this world something called nirvana, where you could relinquish this world and sort of float out to another world, which people do by drinking and taking drugs, or by sleeping till 12 o'clock every day. The same thing. It's an escape. Because you hate the world so much, and the world is so filled with things that you don't like, that you don't want to contend with it at all. You don't want to deal with the world, you're sleeping. You sleep, you take drugs, it's all the same thing. It's a lot cheaper this way. But you have people here, I know in the room, but there are people that sleep on a Sunday, they'll sleep till 2 o'clock. And on a weekday, they're off, they'll sleep till 1 o'clock, and then they take another nap sometimes. So all of this is a frightening way of dealing with things in the world that you don't want. And it's all, of course, saying, oh, I need more sleep. It's all escaping from the world, running away from the world. It's like Jonah at the bottom of the boat. The whole world is falling to pieces. The boat is sinking, and everybody's calling out to their God. And Jonah's floor, he's sleeping. Everybody's praying, screaming, help us. And Jonah's sleeping at the bottom of the boat. Sleep, you run away. Everything is nice. You close your eyes. You lie down. It's a temporary form of suicide. That sleep is not being, of course, the person needs to sleep. I'm not talking about normal sleep. I'm talking about abnormal sleep. My father always is amazing. He asks, how come you don't know nobody needs 12 hours of sleep? And we used to work 12 hours. Here people are working for 8 hours and they have to sleep for 13, 14 hours. It's an amazing thing. Because life has become so disappointing. And it's become so sickening. And there's so much misery and unhappiness that there's an escape from the world. And this is the religion of Buddhism. In Western philosophy, if you've ever read the writings of Schopenhauer, if you know who he was, if you read the writings of Schopenhauer, you'll know that he's just a sophisticated, westernized version of Buddhism, which means the world is terrible, evil has taken over, there's nothing to do except to wait till the end, or to escape in the meantime. You're not allowed to commit suicide, because the gods have determined that you have to live your miserable life. But in the meantime, take drugs, or meditate, or escape in whatever way you can. Because the world is terrible. This is the second way of dealing with evil. So this is Buddhism, Eastern religion, and Schopenhauer and some of his kaveim that they were from his school. The third approach to evil. You could call this partial yayish, partial despair. Rav Kook describes this approach. There is no way that you could save the world from evil. There's nothing you can do about it. Same. You can't do it. You can't change. You can't fix the world. Evil is there to stay. It can't be changed. The only solution is that which the Gemara has at the beginning of Bava Metzia, when you have a certain kind of a dispute, that's called Yachloka. We make a division, we make a split. What's the split? Physical life is right, evil. Physical life is terrible. There's nothing you can do about it. There are catastrophes, children dying, earthquakes, deserts that kill people, there's immorality. There's all kinds of stuff going on. You can't do anything about it. The physical world is terrible. Society, culture, all of this is terrible. and there's nothing you can do about it. So what can you do? The soul, the spiritual part of life is good. That is good. The spiritual is good. So what these people say, and I'll tell you in a moment who they are, I'm sure by now you know who they are, what this philosophy says is that the body is the physical life is still evil. Let's try to salvage what we can. And what can we salvage? The spiritual life. Therefore, this philosophy, this thought, the great people of this school said that to get married is evil. Getting married is evil. Because physical relations are ugly. Physical life is disgusting. You're filled with sin and evil and you're loathsome. Therefore, the chosen people of that religion didn't get married. They don't believe in marriage. You're not supposed to get married because marriage is disgusting and low. They stayed away from government. They didn't want, even though in medieval times, you know, of course, I'm talking about Christianity now. In medieval times, the church literally controlled Europe, at the same time professing that what is given to Caesar, what is Caesar's, unto God, what is God. In other words, that the politics, the economy, this is all evil. It's terrible. Stay away from it. All you can do is to serve God. The great and holy people are called upon to purify themselves and not to get married, to be priests and nuns and monks and all of this, to stay away from marriage. Marriage is ugly. It causes this, it brings about this disgusting physical relationship. This is the world of Christianity. This is the world of Christianity. So let's see, so far we have three. Number one is the belief that there is nothing that's evil. Everything that's evil is good. Everything that's evil is good. We can call that Nazism if you want to. It's not a religion, but it was almost a religion. Nothing is wrong. And not only everything is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to kill Jews. It's a mitzvah to have prostitutes. It's a mitzvah to kill children and so on and so forth. The second approach towards evil, the second way of dealing with evil, is there's nothing to do, it's winning, just wait till you die. In the meantime, take drugs or close your eyes and dream and stuff like that. There are billions of people in history that have done this stuff. You might not know anybody personally, but this is a serious business. The third approach of Christianity is to evil, is that what are you going to do? It's a losing proposition. The physical world stinks, terrible, terrible. Evil is ugly. It's against God. It's filthy. Did you ever read a sermon by Jonathan Edwards? He's a Puritan. It's called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Oh, that's unbelievable thing. Let me read it with you. Sinners, you know that guy? Sinners, that God is holding you like an insect over a fire. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. You're going to be burned. You're going to be toasted. Your body is terrible and evil, and all those guys are evil. So Christianity says, so there's only one thing to do. Try to salvage the soul. The spiritual, get salvation, you know, believe in this, believe in that, you'll be saved, and so on and so forth. The fourth approach, of course, Rakhul calls the Shifat HaKodesh, the approach of holiness, the way that the Jewish people understand evil. Not how we understand it, how we deal with it. I'm not talking about understanding, how we deal with it. What's the Shifat HaKodesh? He says, the cook writes, see how medic la'akil at hakol. Judaism believes that everything in the world can be fixed. Everything can be fixed. And if the Rambam, when he wrote about why the desert in the world, who needs it? What are they for? They're good for movies. What do you need a desert for? So the Rambam says that a human being can fix a desert. That people can fix deserts and change them, can plant, can turn them over. And illnesses also, Rambam says. Why is it such a habit? Why does Hashem allow such vacuums in the world so they can be built? They can be fixed. Hashem wrote the Hashem gave us the power to fix these things. So Judaism teaches that not one thing in the world that is wrong, not one thing in the world that is evil, even on that level of cosmic stuff, even in that world of things that seem to be beyond our control, how those things can be fixed, we'll talk about maybe we'll get to later. That doesn't mean you can stop an earthquake from happening. Judaism believes that the inwardness of evil is caused by good. That evil itself is simply good that has descended into this world and has taken horrible forms. And there's nothing, God forbid, that is purely evil in the world. There's no pure evil. When we said before that evil exists, evil is a perverted form of good. But if a person struggles and tries to come to the depth of fulfilling what the Tzar calls the reason that we're recreated. You know, the Tzar asks, why was a human being sent to this world? The soul had it very good before it came to this world, and it has a very good after this world. So why did Hashem send the soul into this world? What do you need it for? So the Tzar says, to change that which is bitter into sweet, and to change the darkness into light. That man's goal in this world, to take evil by the horns, to take wrath, to take things, to take, and to turn it around, to fix, to raise, to elevate. So society is not evil. If left alone, it will become evil. But it can be fixed. You can have it, and the Torah itself suggests, the Torah gives commandments how to run a society, how to appoint judges, and how to live. Marriage is not ugly. Marriage is beautiful. Physical relations are beautiful if they're conducted according to the will of Hashem. Everything in the world can be fixed. Everything in the world can be beautiful. Everything is tight. Everything is good. Everything. This is called the Shitas HaKodesh. This is the Jewish approach of how we deal with suffering, how we deal with evil. To somehow turn it around. To somehow turn it around. That means when a person's going through a difficult time, I'll explain this more in a few minutes, when a person's going through a difficult time, to try in that world that he's in, to find a way to turn it around. Or the words of Rabbi Nachman, to take a person who's on the side and Jews are dancing, doesn't want the team to join the dance, to bring him into the dance. And there's a way that evil can be brought into the dance. Now Bilam HaRasha, is the one with the evil eye. And the meaning of that is that Bilam is completely immersed. Bilam is completely immersed in evil, with all of his wisdom, with all of his spirituality, with all of his power, with all of his kaifis. Bilam is completely immersed in evil. Rav Kook writes, Osam HaMisaklam, these are people, a person like Bilam, he wants Ra, he wants evil, he wants the forces of Ra to overwhelm and overtake the world. It's a religion. Evil is a religion. They mashkuin derisham, it's makum elahus, make him in its yusa. They rejoice in evil. They take pleasure in evil. So what's unbelievable here in this parsha, you all know that Hashem turned around the curse of Bilam into a blessing, right? And all of you know, I'm sure many of you know, that the brachas that Bilam gave in the Torah, the blessings that he gave, are all about what's going to be with the Jewish people when? In the days of Mashiach, right at the end of time. The nevuahs of the Torah, the Rambam brings these as the source of what we know about Mashiach. The prophecies of Bilam, the curses that were changed to blessings, are all blessings regarding what's going to be, or most of them are blessings regarding what's going to be with the Jewish people at the end of time, when Mashiach comes. So this is a remarkable thing. How could it be that Dr. Bilam, the one who has within his hands the spiritual power of evil, who was the proponent of the first approach of evil, which means to sanctify evil, the Shivas HaKodesh, Nazism, vicious evil for some sake. So why did Hashem do such a thing? How could it be that Dr. this person, Bilam, the person of cosmic evil, that Dr. he is the one who tells us about the end of time when everything will be good? The days of Mashiach, when everything will be fixed, everything will be wonderful. Dr. these blessings come from the mouth of that maneuver, of that destructive evil person, Bilam. Like Rabbi could have said it. Aaron Akon could have said these things. Miriam and Azia, there are plenty of good people in Tanakh. Bilam is the one who tells us about the end of time. When what? Everything will be good. Everything will be good. Why is it? You know what pessimism means? How many of you are pessimists? Huh? I'm always a pessimist. I'm the worst pessimist in the world. The world can be divided between two types of people. There are optimists and there are pessimists. You're not neutral. There are pessimists, I'm going to talk about that also. There are pessimists, and we need a couple more minutes, and optimists. But Cook says, in all his front tell us, that pessimism is a terribly evil thing. To look at the world in an ugly way, that's the way of the world. I am hurt. What does it mean in evil eyes? That everything in the world is ugly. Everything is bad, everything is ugly. Your life is ugly. People are not nice. Everybody's against you. Your friends are not good friends. Your friends are not loyal to you. You didn't get a fair chance in the world. America stinks, this stinks, everything stinks. Nothing is good. I mean, the eternal pessimism. Nothing works out, nothing will be good. So pessimism
because we're short on time. Pessimism is a very dangerous thing.
It's against the Torah.
However, the book says that since the Jewish people believe that in everything that is evil, there is something good to be found, the cultural wants to there. What good could there possibly, I want to explain this to you, what good could there possibly be in atheism?
Some believe also, you get, actually, it's pro-religious when someone comes in for help. Maybe there's a help and everything. May God help you. So the cousin says, listen, you know, for a second, stop believing in God. Believe in your own copy. It doesn't mean God thinks you should believe in Hashem. You understand? Be blessed. In every single thing, there's something good. So a book is, a book that in pessimism itself, in pessimism itself, there's Tov, there's something that is good in pessimism. What could there be that's good in pessimism? That which sees everything like Bilam, which is evil and bad, and nothing is good. Hashem Yerachem, Hashem should save us from looking at the world such a way. But what good is there in pessimism? So I'm going to say something that's very, very deep that Rav Kook wrote. And I'm working on it today to understand this and how to apply it. Rav Kook said that the good that can be found in pessimism, he calls Hanetil Ahadah. Hanetil Ahadah means that with the, even though pessimism is a terrible mistake, and if you look at the world as being terrible, you're a fool, that the world is good. Nevertheless, the book says there is something to be gained. There's something holy. There's a holy kernel. There's a holy little seed inside of pessimism. And that what's that? That's the realization that this world is not ultimately evil. The realization that man needs to be redeemed in this world. That the world is, that this world is not the way it's supposed to be. The need, the desire to be redeemed and to be relieved from evil. In other words, for a person to give up his tight hold on this world. Pessimism is, the inner voice of pessimism tells you that this world is not worth fighting so much for. It's not worth it. It's not worth fighting for. The pessimist is disappointed with reality. The pessimist is disappointed with reality. Reality is not good. He doesn't like it. That's silly. But the underlying root of pessimism gives across this message that there's something better that's going to happen. This night. The pessimist deep down cannot contend with this world because he feels that the world is such a disappointment. The world doesn't live up to what it's supposed to. To what it's supposed to. It means that the underlying essence of the pessimist is the belief. It's just that a silly pessimist never comes to this. But there's a pessimism that our book says is misogynist or misromantic, that is elevated and exalted, which means that the person does not hold on tightly to this world. He doesn't hold on tightly to this world. But things don't go his way. This can bear is okay. Okay. I can tell you the truth. As far as I can recall, I never remember my father, was like, he should be well, ever having an argument with anybody, ever. And whenever I was always hoping he would get into an argument. Why? Because there were things that happened. I remember as a kid, you know, like, it could be anything. We'd be pulling, my father would pull over at the park someplace, and some guy would go pull in, right? And my mother and the rest of us would say, come on, daddy, come on, we know what you do. You know? And my father would say, like, you know, it's a big deal, you know, if someplace else. Not in that book. He says it's not worth it. Like, what's it worth? The whole thing, what's it worth? What's it worth? Why don't you stop with sugar? My father used to always say, what's it worth? Now, I remember even as a small child, I was 5 years old, I remember my father, I remember as a little kid, my father telling me, what do you think the whole world you live 70, 80 years, it's not, it doesn't pay. I remember as a child, hearing my father say that, what's getting there? What are you getting upset? What is it? You know, it was inside pessimism, it's a disappointment with reality, the realization of reality, the desire. And that gives birth to a belief that there's something that must be there beyond this world. There must be that this world is something else. Therefore, listen to what happened to Bilam. This is an amazing thing, based upon what our book is saying here, so understand what happened to Bilam. That for one moment, God gave Bilam the ability to see. To see correctly. For one moment. For a few moments. He had the ability to see. The one who described the Torah that had an eye that was shut, whose eye was blinded, he could see.
And what did he see? Wasn't that person who was so embedded in evil, who saw only evil in the world, who saw only worthlessness and ugliness and filth in the world, for that one moment when Hashem opened his eyes, what did he see? He saw that the whole world, with all the suffering and all the misery and all the craziness, is nothing. He saw that beyond this world is something unbelievable. And only the one who saw the depth of evil, only the one who worshipped evil, and who had that veil ripped away from his eyes, and he saw that, you know what? You're absolutely right. This world is worth nothing. Not because it's worth nothing, the world is so sweet and good, but it's worth nothing compared to what's going to be when the Shia comes. And then the same man who opened his mouth to curse everything was the one who brought to the world the blessings of the end of time and the Shia, when everything will be good. That new world, when everything will be fixed, and everything will be right, everything will be the way it's supposed to be. So that's the one who descended into the depths of evil. In other words, the most bitter, frightening pessimist that ever lived, only he could give up so much believing in this world to the point that Hashem could show him with a clarity of vision the world that's beyond this world. But this isn't a simple idea. In the story of the seven beggars, in 5 minutes, in the story of the seven beggars, Rabbi Nachman, before he died, began to tell stories. And if you've ever seen these stories, if you've ever heard them, they've been translated into many, many, many languages. And there are many books explaining the stories. Every single word in the story is understood on many levels. These are not sound stories. In the story of the seven beggars, which is the most remarkable of all, the story is the last one that he tells. In that story, one of the beggars is blind. And Rebbe writes over there, tells him the story, that at the wedding of that Chosman Kala, that bride and groom, in that story, if you read the story, you know what I'm talking about, the wedding of the bride and of the Chosman Kala. So the Chosman Kala suddenly said, oh, if only, this Chosman Kala, this young man and woman were very, very, very poor, they didn't have parents, and there were seven beggars that helped them at the time that they were going through difficult times, they wanted them eventually. At their wedding, each of the seven beggars shows up to give them a present. And each one's present is a story. So, on the first day, at the wedding festival, at the Simcha, the Chosma Kal, the young man and woman say, oh, if only the blind beggar who was so good to us when we were children, he gave us when we had nothing in the forest, he gave us bread seed, if only he could join us at the Simcha. And there he was. The blind beggar stepped in. And I can't tell you now the story that he told me. The gift that he gave them was so amazing. So let me just tell you the first words that the blind beggar said. He said like this. Let me give you the translation from the Rabbi Kaplan's translation. The story is in Yiddish, and we also translate it in English. If you think that I am blind, you think the blind beggar says, you think that I am blind? These are people who are begging for alms. You think that I am blind? In fact, I am not blind at all. But to me, the time of the whole world is not worth a moment's fleeting glance. I am very old and still very young. Despite my great age, I have not even begun to live. That's how he said, and he says, now I will give you a gift. It's a story of how to be old and very young. How to be young and how to be old. It's the story of time. So listen to the words over here. Listen to the words. This is an amazing thing. You think that I am blind, in fact I'm not blind at all. But to me the time of the whole world is not worth a moment's fleeting glance. It's just not worth it. I am very old and still very young. Despite my great age, I have not even begun to live. What the blind beggar is saying is, I'm not blind at all. His vision is so great. His vision, the depth of the vision of the blind beggar is so amazing, his vision, that he doesn't perceive the details of mundane, silly existence. His vision is so far. His vision is so broad. His way of looking at things is so amazing and so big and so deep that he doesn't look at the mundane details of existence. He says, you think that I'm blind? I don't see this world because I see worlds beyond this world. If I'm not looking at this world, I'm blind to this world. I'm blind to this world. He sees everything through the eyes of Messiah, through the eyes of the end,
through the eyes of eternity, through the perspective of forever. That's when he sees everything. You and I don't look at things like that. Like you saw that last week, you're standing at the bus stop, and the bus driver goes right past you. You start screaming, and you go to run to call up the, whatever it's called, the Department of Buses or something. Then you call up and say, you know, a chutzpah, the Q44, when I tell you, they don't know that I'm one of the most important members of the Bukhari community. My father, my grandfather's pictures on the wall, and the bus when I passed me, a chutzpah. Yeah, what a chutzpah. The whole world is chutzpah. The whole world is against you. The whole world is mistreating you. Everything in the world gets you annoyed and upset. And you say that I have very good vision. I see everything. Every person ever upset me, I see. Every single thing in the world that is wrong, I see. Every single thing in the world that is not perfect, I see. I see. And the blind artist says, I see nothing at all of this world. I'm blind. You think that I'm blind? I'm not blind, he says. He says, I am very old, but I'm very young. Very old means I'm from the end of time, I'm from the beginning of time, and I'm very young because I'm going to be to the end of time. Because that's where I look. I see everything from the perspective of the end. I see everything the way that it's supposed to be. The way that it's supposed to be. So now we understand what happened to Bilam. That for that moment, the one who was blind, Bilam whose eye was shut, Bilam who had a sickness of how he looked at the world as evil, Bilam the pessimist, for that second, for those few minutes, Hashem showed him. Hashem took the blind man and opened his eyes and made him blind to the misery, made him blind to the suffering. So what does Judaism say about pessimists and optimists? What does Judaism say? What about pessimists? The pessimist is the person who sees all the details of this world. Understand that. The pessimist is the person who looks at all the details of the world. And the world is not, the world has a lot of unpleasant details. And because you look at all the unpleasant details of the world, your life is an unpleasant life. It's that simple. Your life is just unpleasant. If you're a pessimist, you just look at all the, you look at all the unpleasant details. And then you have the choice. Then you could go back to the other way. You could become a drug addict and run away from the world. Or you could blast music into your head all day. Those people that can't be separated from their amplifiers for a moment, those people are the most pitiful people in the world, because their lives have been so miserable. They've been brought up in such horror. They've seen so many disgusting, horrible things that the only thing they can do about it is just blast the stuff through their head day and night. It's the same thing as running away. It's all the same. So that's the choice of the person, the pessimist, who sees all the details of the world. If you're focused on every detail of the world, so what's your choice? So Christianity says that the physical world thinks that you could be like, you know, you could have salvation, so then you could run up to some commune and, you know, and bow down to Yoshka or something. Or you could become a drug addict, an alcoholic, or a drug addict, or an alcoholic, or a sleepaholic, or a workaholic. All these alcoholics are all running away from truth. People who are working day and night, it's all. People work with money, there's all ways of escaping them. There are different ways to escape. Some people want to escape. People escape with music, people escape with drugs, people escape with sex, people escape with an education. So the people are hiding behind the degrees of their education. This is the pessimist, who is so frightened by the details of life and of the world that he has to just get away from it. Because the world, if you look at the details, forget it. It's unbearable. It's just unbearable. So what should a person do? What does it mean, optimist? Listen to this sentence how Rav describes an optimist. Avodah Gedolah Mi'ira is a great, enlightened way of serving God. Lahasir et hakas legamei min halev, to remove anger completely from the heart. To remove anger from the heart. Lahabit al hakol ba'ayin yasa, to look at everything with a beautiful eye. In a beautiful way. With an eye that's beautiful. The chemla, what's chemla? With compassion. She'ein l'gvul, it has no end. With compassion, it has no end. L'hidamot l'ayin ha'elyona, that your eye should be like the eye of God. Eina ilah, the supernal, the elevated eye. Eina d'kula chivra, the eye of whiteness. That's from Kabbalah, the eye of whiteness.
But Judaism doesn't say, forgive me for taking an extra few minutes, Judaism doesn't say, still ignore evil. What happens if you ignore evil? So as long as you get a happy. So what do you say about the optimist is a fool, right? So what about the happy optimist? He sees all kinds of stories in the world. You're not saying that you think that, people say that. What do you say about, what does the optimist say about all the stories in the world? Oh, it's okay. That's an optimist. Everything's fine. Someone's lying in this world, wouldn't you? It'll be alright. Everything's okay. Don't be disappointed. Oh, it's pretty bad. It's okay. There are other people in the world. You tell me that. There are other children in your family. Yeah, it's okay. That's an optimist. Not somebody that's a jerk. That's not optimism. A person who's an optimist of that type doesn't do anything about the world to fix the evil. And the whole point of being Jewish is to contend with evil. To try to fix it, to do something, to help, to turn things around, to change that which is better than that which is sweet. So if you're that kind of optimist that says everything is wonderful, everything is beautiful, that's another way to escape. That's also a way to escape. That was the 1960s, and all the hippies, the flower children. That's also the music. All this music in the 60s about love, everybody loving everybody in Woodstock, everybody hugging and kissing. You know that old man. Everything is beautiful, you're beautiful, I love you. Say your own thing, do your thing. Life is groovy. You don't know these words. These are words from a long time ago. During that time, huh? Everything is beautiful. Everything is great. But what? Again, it's a lot cheaper than drugs and psychotherapy. It's a lot cheaper than the rest of this stuff. But it's the same thing. I will skip. Everything is fine. That's not optimism. That's a fool. That's another way to escape. The optimism of the Torah is look at things in a big way. Look at things in a big way. There's evil in the world, but there's more good. There's more good. And so Baruch Hu, Hashem, his brother, has given you the power to defeat him, to beat him. And that's the story of Bilam. Bilam said himself, he was put into his mouth, he said himself, this wasn't even put into his mouth, he said, that's Hashem Torah, you are, Hashem Tevarech Malach. What you want to curse, you can curse. And if you want to bless, you can bless. That's what Judaism says. You want to curse your life? You want to curse everything in the world? You want to look at the world with that eye? Destruction? That's for you. But if you want to bless the world, you want to fix the world, you want to change the world, that's also for you. That's also for you. There's a certain Hashikaris that wrote a story. This is a Jew that wrote many stories in Yiddish and in English. Most of the stories are of very low nature. He won a Nobel Prize. He's not alive anymore. It's not how he lived out. No. So this person came from a chassidic home and became very confused. He had uncontrollable desires for things that are not proper. And because of that, he believed that the whole world had the same desires as he did. But he was a wonderful writer. And he has a story. I'm not going to tell you the name of the story because I don't want you to go buying his books or reading his books if you think it's interesting. And this story is amazing, but maybe I told it to you once. In this story, he tells about a certain Jew, a Talmud Chacham, a scholar, a wealthy person. And the story is told by the Satan, by the Satan, evil one. And the evil one, the Satan, is trying to get to this guy, this Talmud Chacham, this Tzaddik. He's a real good guy. He can't get to him. He tries, you know, money, and he tries with the women, all the good things to get to him. You know, the Satan is trying to work on this guy. Guy, he's not working. Can't get him. Huh. The last thing the Satan tries is guidance. Guidance can seek the ego. Because that, you know, you can get a Talmud Chacham on that. So he comes to this Tzaddik and tells him, you know, what do you get out of being such a Talmud Chacham? What do you get out of being such a Tzaddik? You know, by the Jews, they have a lot of people like you. Brilliant and good. If you would convert and become a Christian, you could be the Pope. They don't have anybody like that. You could be the Pope, like in a year or two, you do it. They're not smart like that, they don't have anything like that. You could do it. And day after day, you're getting you start to think, you know, well, like, yeah, I guess I didn't come home. I sit in the 10th row, you know, the big rabbanim, and I sit in the 10th row, and, you know,
I'm just another Jew, Jews. You know, there are a lot of smart, good Jews.
So there's going on there. Then, so finally, he had it, he decided to convert. Expecting great glory and honor and wealth, says. Because you know the folks were very wealthy people. So, he converts. And in the beginning, the church gives him tremendous honor. He is brilliant, and it's a big cash, and they show him a lot of honor, a lot of respect. The Jews, of course, have nothing to do with him. He's spat upon, he's hated, his father, a traitor. But the Goyim give him a lot of trouble, for around a year. But since the Goyim hate Jews like that too, because they don't, nobody likes a traitor, really deep down. And they saw what he really was a money-hungry, honor-seeking, shallow person. In short, he was rejected by everybody. And he went through his life, he lost all his money, and he became blind. The end of the story, I'm skipping the whole thing, but the end of the story, this is the last scene. Listen to this scene. It's a powerful scene. The end of the story, you have this guy, he no longer calls himself by a Jewish name. He had a Jewish name, he calls himself with some fancy Latin name. The end of the story, he's sitting on the steps of the big church. And he's blind, and he's beggar. Not like our blind beggar. And he's sitting there with a plate, you know, that's all he has, a couple of Chinese people do. And he's going over his life. And it's amazing, the only thing he remembers is that he learned some Gemara, he remembers the Gemara he learned, you know, above Messiah, above Kama, he remembers Gemara, he remembers Tanakh, he remembers what it was like to be by Rebbe, by Tzaddik, he remembers going to the Mikveh, he remembers the Shaykh, and it's bothering. Because he stopped believing in God. Long ago, he stopped believing in God. That's how the sect stopped and took away from his belief. Then he went to the church just to, you know, as an opportunity, just to get money, to get some faith. But he didn't believe in God. And all he's thinking about here, sitting on the steps with his pushka, with his little plate, all he's thinking about is God and Torah and Gemara, you know, all this stuff. And all of a sudden, somebody approaches him and says to him, calls him by his Jewish name. The way that he used to be calling him as a child, which is Zedula. Calls him Zedula. He hasn't heard that since he's a young person, you know, since he's a child, Zedel. His nickname, his Yiddish nickname. So he's blind, he says, who is that? He says, you don't know who I am? You don't recognize me? He says, no, who are you? Come on. You don't remember me? He says, I'm the Malach HaMavet, I'm the Angel of Death. Remember I came to you, you know, spoke to you in the past many times, and I had a whole deal with you and things? It's me. I'm here to take you away. So Zedula says, take me where? This is the way you think. It's time to die. So where are you taking me? Where do you think you're going to go? So Zedula says, to hell? He says, sure thing. Sure thing. So he says, really? That's fantastic! You're fantastic! He says, you're insane, come with me. He says, what do you mean? He says, I'm going to go with you. He says, because you know why? He says to the Satan, you're a liar. You came to me 40 years ago and you told me God doesn't exist and you're a liar. God exists. So the Satan said, the angel of death said, God doesn't exist. What are you, stupid? He doesn't exist. She says, he does exist. He says, no, he doesn't. Then where are you taking me? I'm taking you to hell. So he said, well, if hell exists, that means that heaven also exists. And if you exist, then he said God also exists. And the end of the story is that Zedula will go singing an old niggin that he remembered as a child into Gehenna, into hell, singing a niggin. An old niggin. He had to go to Gehenna, right?
Sure.
He had to do his time. But he went through with a niggin. It's an amazing story. This is what a person should take from evil, nothing else. That if there's such a thing in the world that exists, and the world is such an unbelievable, crazy, mixed up place, he has to know that if that exists, there's a trillion, billion times faster than this place that exists. Never waiting for it. Hashem should make us worthy that every one of us should come to the Torah, should come to the good before we end up, God forbid, in such a way to have to sit on some steps somewhere, waiting for the Malach HaMavet to take us. We should in our own lives take ourselves the right way. But we should open our eyes to see, not like Bilam for one moment, but to see our whole lives, to look for good in other Jews, to look for good in other people, to look for good in everything, to see things in a good way, an ayin tov. And if we look at things in a good way, then Hashem has promised us that He'll look at us in a good way, and He'll bless each and every one of us with everything that we need in the physical world and in the spiritual world.